Hi, I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. In each episode, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. In today's episode, I'm joined by my friend Anya Manuel, who's the co-founder and partner at the consulting firm Rice Hadley Gates and Manuel LLC, and executive director of the Aspen Strategy Group and the Aspen Security Forum, which in recent years has emerged as a go-to gathering for military, intelligence community, and foreign policy players. Anya has particular expertise and experience on Asia and tech policy, so I was delighted to sit down with her to exchange views on recent geopolitical developments, including strategic realignments towards the Indo-Pacific region and the implications for the global tech industry. Our conversation covers a lot of ground, from challenges to innovation and research ecosystems to minilateralism and competition with China. There's a lot to discuss, so let's dive in.
Great to be with you, Anya. Hope this finds you well.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for doing this with me, Rana.
Last summer, President Biden signed the Chips and Sciences Act, which seeks to bolster semiconductor production in the U.S., and its rationale is both a national security rationale and also a economic rationale, trying to outperform China in all of these regards. You've written of a potential shadow war on tech between China and the United States. How do you see these latest moves by the U.S. on chip production, and how will they affect the U.S.'s ability to compete with China, and how will they affect U.S. supply chains around the world?
Yeah, thank you, Rana, and thank you for having me on the podcast. I am a big supporter of the Chips and Science Act. It was hard fought, ultimately passed by big bipartisan majorities, so it does show that Washington can agree on some things, sometimes if only to be tough on China. But it does a few important things. The headline, of course, is that it provides over $52 billion for American semiconductor research, development of manufacturing, workforce development. It also provides some tax credits going forward so that we move not all of the semiconductor manufacturing back to the U.S., but some of the most critical and most advanced things, which currently are happening almost exclusively in Asia, in particular in Taiwan, South Korea, and elsewhere. And the part that's not so emphasized in the Chips and Science Act is the science piece. And I think this is actually the most important. And that is, it gives $170 billion over multiple years to do advanced research and development by the federal government in basic science. Now, we used to do a huge amount of this during the Cold War. Over the past decades, the percentage of our GDP that the U.S. is spending on this has declined. And of the part that we're doing, more of it has gone to health and bio, which has, you know, helped us a lot when we got the vaccines after the pandemic, but less and less into kind of other hard sciences. And let me just zoom out a little bit and explain why I think those things are important. When you look at what's now been called the tech decoupling between the US and China, most of the actions you saw, both by the Trump administration and frankly by the Chinese, is on the defensive side. You know, how to keep our tech in and their money out, and not, you know, export controls and investment restrictions. The Chips and Science Act does the opposite. It says, we're going to stand up our own innovation ecosystem in the United States and also in Canada and Europe and other advanced economies, and we're going to compete. And I think that's a much better approach. Rather than trying to tear the other guy down, we're trying to build ourselves up.
With this overarching context, Anya and I focus on the importance of international partnerships in building innovation ecosystems.
Let me dig into that second part of what you just said in terms of how the United States will work with partners going forward. And I note a speech by Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo recently, which was quite, you know, laid out the case that you have just laid out, but also the mention of partners was there. But where do you think that this partnership is going? And I know the Europeans have a different view on it. How do you see this new supply chain sort of working?
Yeah, that's such a perfect question. And I am just back. Last week, I was in Brussels leading a senior U.S. delegation on part of the Aspen Strategy Group, which I direct. Mm-hmm. We met with several of the EU commissioners who work on these issues and with other senior officials in Brussels to talk about exactly this. How closely can the U.S., Canada, and Europe cooperate on issues of technology? And, you know, you don't really say it out loud, but it's a little bit vis-a-vis China. And I have to tell you, I think the Europeans have come a long way. From a few years ago, when we first started having these conversations, there was a lot of hesitancy on the European side, especially the Germans, understandably, because they have such a huge economic relationship with China. And frankly, one of the few countries in the world that actually has an export surplus towards China. And you heard a lot of, well, we should be equidistant, and of course we want to trade, and, you know, hedging their bets. This time, I heard really across the board, wow, this Xi Jinping's China is a different country than the one that we dealt with 6, 7, 8 years ago before Xi Jinping came to power. The Chinese are being extremely aggressive. You heard Wang Yi at the Munich Security Conference give an extreme wolf warrior speech. I think it shocked everyone in the audience. And by and large, what we found with our interlocutors in Brussels, but also from the Germans, the UK and others, is a huge willingness to cooperate with the United States, especially on these issues of building ourselves up. How do we build our own innovation ecosystem? How do we help make sure our technology companies stay in the lead? On semiconductors, a huge amount of agreement, of course, on clean tech, on some of the things that are happening with the Inflation Reduction Act, less so, but on kind of the hard sciences, semiconductors, AI, quantum, certain aspects of biotech, the ones where we really think it's important to stay a few generations ahead of where China is, I think there's enormous agreement.
Talent and research are key components undergirding the tech ecosystem. I ask Anya for insights on how current geopolitical realities are affecting open research and innovation communities.
In the context of this bifurcation that, as you note, seems to be gaining traction in capitals around the world, talent and critical research capacities has been an aspect of globalization that you've that has, you know, been quite successful in some measures, and some might say a bit too successful. And that transfer between countries like the United States, like China, like India and others, of research professionals going back and forth. How do you see that world, which often doesn't get spoken about much, but I know you know a lot about, how do you see that world responding to this new bifurcation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's two aspects of this. One is the research students, universities, national labs, kind of the research enterprise. And second is the workforce enterprise, people working in private sector tech companies. Let me speak about the first one first. I'll just speak for the US because I did a paper on this a couple of years ago with some friends from Stanford and MIT and others who are deep in the research game. I would say the US and also our friends and allies were a little bit naive about our research enterprise. We were very open. We should keep being very open because that benefits all of us. If you look at the best science that's being done, it's done on international teams. And so we shouldn't shut down and out China and try to keep all Chinese researchers out. Far from it. But the rules that already exist about conflicts of interest, about being transparent about where your funding is coming from, about telling people who are researching in your labs and your universities that if you are spying for a foreign government, be it China or anyone else, there will be real consequences. You will be arrested and sent to jail. Those kinds of, you know, brush your teeth and floss things weren't really happening. My sense is that they're happening more now in the US side. We had a really positive conversation with some folks from the UK and from Europe about this exact issues. And I would say the Europeans are maybe a couple of years behind realizing this, but they're starting to do it too. So the bottom line on research, my view is we don't have to change our system. We want it to be open, but we do want to be careful that those few foreigners, and it's a minority, especially the Chinese, who are being encouraged by their government to spy, should not be allowed to do so. On the workforce piece, it's obviously much bigger and more complicated. There's some that's really extremely high tech. There's some that's kind of less high tech. One of the issues in the CHIPS Act is, do we in the US even have the talent to build these semiconductor fabs? We don't. Most of that talent is in Asia. So we're going to have to train it in some ways. I think it's a good thing that people move back and forth, and we should have a lot of immigration. It makes our system stronger to be open and resilient and get the best minds from the world. It's one of our great strengths. The Chinese have weaponized that a little bit with the 1,000 Talents program and others, where they bring people back to China and give them multiples of what they would earn in Canada or in the US and Europe. My guess is that now, with Xi Jinping's extreme crackdown and moving really from an authoritarian state to a totalitarian state, that some of the best technologists and scientists from China will want to come to the West. So we'll see what the next couple of years hold.
From here, our conversation focuses on the strategic realignment towards the Indo-Pacific region that is currently underway.
That's fascinating, and we could no doubt go deeper into that that topic. Let me change gears for a moment and ask you about the Indo-Pacific strategies of many countries now that in the midst of this new geoeconomic and geopolitical reordering, the presencing or putting Indo-Pacific into the foreground has been a real activity amongst many governments at this stage. Canada has recently produced its Indo-Pacific strategy, as have many other governments that are allied with it. How do you see this whole activity of creating Indo-Pacific strategies? And what do you see as the cornerstone of all of the various efforts that you're seeing around the world?
Yeah, great question. When I was back serving at the State Department a long time ago now, ending in late 2007, we were very careful about this because the goal was to bring China onto the governing board of the world, to be not too aggressive and push them in the wrong direction. I think it's mostly the Chinese side that has shown that they weren't willing to take the outstretched hand. And so what you're seeing is you're seeing the tectonic plates of the international system realigning in a pretty dramatic fashion. So whereas in the mid-2000s, the approach of the Quad, you know, Japan, Australia, the US and India doing exercises together was seen as way too assertive. Now, of course, you see the Quad doing everything together. Military exercises, you see Japan massively stepping up how much they're doing for their own defense. You see heads of state meeting, foreign ministers meeting, defense ministers meeting. And frankly, it's happening because China is scaring people. You see a new defense relationship that's been rejuvenated between the US and the Philippines. No basing rights, but we're going to be hosting some things there, leaving some equipment there. That wouldn't have happened several years ago. And I would just say, the world doesn't want to align China. China is frightening the world. And I have to say again, having spent the last 10 days in Europe, the Europeans, who were always very cautious on this, are now quite forward leaning. I heard from senior officials at NATO that those statements that NATO has made about there being a systemic challenger in China is real, and they intend to back it up, not with a permanent presence in the Pacific, but with rotating people through. The new German defense minister said on the record that Germany has a real interest in the Indo-Pacific, and that the exercises they participated recently in an Australian military exercise called Pitch Black, that they're going to continue to do that. So you see the system realigning frankly, because we're worried.
Anya and I discussed the patchwork of multilateral institutions, from AUKUS to the Quad and APEC, all of which are players in the Indo-Pacific region.
Of the multilateral institutions that are springing up in the Indo-Pacific, particularly if you think about Quad, AUKUS, IPEF now, in addition to some of the existing institutions there, how do you see this new alignment of institutions, and where do you think the real action is? You mentioned AUKUS, for instance, has and the Quad, both of them have different dimensions to them now that are economic, you know, political, security related dimensions to them. How do you see them evolving in the course of the next few years?
Yeah, it's a very good topic. And let me just zoom out for a second. If you're looking at this as someone who's not a day-to-day foreign policy practitioner, the way I would think about it is as follows. In Europe, there are very mature, formalized institutions, both on the economic side, the EU, and on the military side, NATO. In Asia, we've never had that. And you also underlying all of the different alphabet soup of institutions in Asia have some very bad bilateral relationships. The South Koreans and the Japanese, for example, all sorts of things that are fraught and complicated. Southeast Asia, which understandably has their biggest trading relationships by far, is with China, not with Canada or the US or with Europe. So they have a real interest in keeping peace in the region, but not having two competing blocks with the US or with China or being forced to take sides. And we hear that all the time. So overlay on top of that, a patchwork of institutions that include different parts of these characters. So there's APEC, there's ASEAN, mostly on the economic side. AUKUS, of course, isn't an institution. It is the US, Australia, and the UK coming together to make sure that Australia has the defensive mechanisms in terms of nuclear submarines that they need. It's really a very specific one defense procurement thing rather than an institution. You have the Quad, which isn't a formal institution. It's certainly not an alliance, but it's something that's been useful recently. And so the question remains, how do you use all of these different institutions to make sure both that we are not irreparably damaging relations with the Chinese? Because let me just be clear again, no one wants war with China. People want positive relations with China, even if we sound very hawkish here in the United States a lot. But we are getting concerned. And so that's why you're seeing a renewed emphasis in the Asian institutions such as they are. Rana, you also asked about IPEF. Can I maybe just say a word about that? I can say this because I'm not in the US government. The US has not had a very forward-leaning trade policy for several administrations now. There was a very good, very strong trade deal. I know, Rana, you know this in detail, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was started in the Bush administration, negotiated in the Obama administration, and no one could bring it home. Unfortunately, in the United States, we now have an unholy alliance on the right and on the left that is very protectionist and anti-trade. I think that harms us. It harms our businesses, it harms our consumers, and it certainly harms our relationships in that part of the world, because we're seen as very security heavy and very trade and economics light. It's not a good way to be. So IPEF was the Biden administration's commendable way to try to do something lighter that's not a formal trade agreement, but that has some important points, especially in standards and technology and things that you could basically get through without making it a formal trade agreement that has to go through Congress. I think the reception in Asia has been tepid, muted. And so I worry that if we don't get our act together by this meeting, Washington, the left and the right on trade, that we're really leaving one leg of the stool way underdeveloped. It's harming us.
Can I ask you about an institution that you didn't mention, because there's so many to go around, is APEC, which is going to have its meeting in San Francisco in November. And what can we expect from an organization like APEC, which is has some history behind it and some institutional heft? What could be achieved there?
Very good point. So APEC is often underrated because people think, oh, it's just another big talk shop. They have done some really important things, including on tech standards. And of course, it is an opportunity for everyone in Asia, large and small countries, to get together and hash out some of their differences. So I think it's very important. The U.S. hasn't chaired it, I think, since 2011. I think we have a real opportunity here to show our non-security face to Asia, to show our community building face, our economic face, and really get reintegrated in that region in a way that is quite critical. So I'm optimistic.
Given this background, I ask Anya for her perspective on the role of Canada in the Indo-Pacific.
And because this is a Canadian podcast that's based in Silicon Valley, and many of our listeners are back in Canada, what kind of a role do you foresee Canada? You've seen our Indo-Pacific strategy, and I know, and we've spoken in the past on this, and you're a keen observer of these issues. Where do you see a country like Canada playing in this new configuration right now? And how do you handicap the strategy that that we put forward?
Yeah, Canada plays an absolutely critical role. I think you are punching way above your weight. And if you look at your, you know, your population compared to ours in the US, and you occupy, to my mind, a really important strategic middle ground. You know, you have a huge Chinese Canadian population, very well educated, very thoughtful. I think a lot of the Chinese who are uncomfortable with where Xi Jinping is taking the country are moving to Canada. That's a really important asset, frankly. I think you can sometimes be a very important interlocutor to soften the rough edges, I would say, of U.S. policy, where we can sometimes sound so hawkish now. You know, the one thing that unites Republicans and Democrats in Washington is being very tough on China in a way that I think sometimes harms us. And you often speak with a more moderate, rational voice. And you also have really positive relationships both in Asia and with our European friends and allies. So, we rely on you a lot, probably more than we sometimes give you credit for.
Last but certainly not least, the war in Ukraine is a huge, critical piece of the current geopolitical puzzle. Anya shares her insight on the conflict as it enters its second year.
I would be remiss to not mention in this interview that we're on the one-year anniversary of Russia's legal invasion of Ukraine, and which has all sorts of reverberating factors, particularly into Europe, certainly, but also into the great game between China and the United States. And how do you see the next year unfolding, just given recent events in the relationship between these powers?
I think Ukraine, in particular, deserves just unbelievable credit for their courage, their persistence, what they have been through for the past year. Would have been much easier to give up. The West has been much more united than we initially thought. And sometimes we don't say this enough. It wasn't obvious a year ago that the US and Europe would be so united, and Canada, that businesses and the government in the United States and in each of those countries would be so united. I mean, American business went way beyond what they needed to do under the sanctions to get out of Russia, to help their Russian employees who wanted to leave, to help Ukraine, to provide humanitarian assistance. I think it's really an unsung positive story. And Republicans and Democrats, you know, you hear a little bit of grumbling on the far left and the far right, but by and large, the center has held. And we have, I think, appropriated $50 billion in aid to Ukraine. I think we've spent about 30 or a little bit more of that. That's very impressive. Now, having congratulated ourselves, we're about to hit the very hard part. The Russian military in war after war, is on the brink of losing, does a really bad job in the beginning, and then throws mass at the problem without a whole lot of regard for their own children's lives. And that's what you're seeing now. So we're really on two timelines. Russia has 300,000 new recruits. They're drafting more. They're giving them basic training. Putin has massively ramped up the production of weapons. Someone told me in Munich a week ago that the Russians are going to be producing 20 tanks a month. That's a lot. Meanwhile, we're arguing over 14 Leopards. It's pretty frustrating. So that's one timeline. The other timeline is how quickly Europe and the US and Canada can help the Ukrainians and really supply them with the arms that they need. Not piecemeal, not a hodgepodge of things that are really hard to work and that are not very interoperable, but really go all in on this, because I worry that this is going to be a very, very difficult year for Ukraine. So we have to keep the solidarity.
I've heard that axiom about war fighting, that precision beats mass over time.
Mm-hmm.
And how much time would be required for the precision that is being offered to the Ukrainian military through direct arms, through training and military assistance? Do you think that we could take from this year? And do you think that we'll be seeing serious battlefield accomplishments and diplomatic accomplishments in the course of this year?
Yeah. Every time that Ukrainians are given advanced precision weapons, they've done an extraordinarily good job, like with the HIMARS. The Biden administration, understandably, is being a little careful and doesn't want to escalate. We don't want an accidental war with Russia. But I would say respectfully, we're now all in. And if you're all in, don't give the Ukrainians enough to lose slowly. Give them enough to win.
That is a brilliant piece to end on, and thank you for that extraordinary insight.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. I hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some fresh perspectives. Additional resources are available in the show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Anya Emanuel for being my guest. Production thanks to Marie Alnick, Kate Walter, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Kathleen Speckert, and Olivia Richardson. I'm Rana Sarkar. Thank you for listening. Until next time.